Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.
It's 8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, after nearly 2 years, the proposed new zones for Summit County's east side have been presented to the public. Three new agricultural-based zones are being considered, as well as three rezone opportunities. The reason for the change, say county planners, is the need to balance property rights with the reality that growth is coming. On the phone with me, I have Summit County Planning Administrator Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie.
So a big public hearing last week, and then a previous hearing had brought out like more than 150 people to that first one. So residents apparently engaged. What are you hearing from them about these proposed changes?
There are a wide range of opinions. I think we're actually thrilled. I'm as thrilled as an Englishman can be about the number of people who actually turned up to the public hearings. We actually used the school auditoriums, North Summit and South Summit, 150 plus at the first meeting, probably slightly less than that number at the last meeting, which was last Thursday, and a wide variety of opinions. Quite diverse as well. The north side tends to be more in favor of the changes, I would say, and the south side tends to be more against the changes. And that's really just from statements that we've heard. We've also got numerous written comments that we're going to have to go through and sort out where everybody's coming from. But generally a very engaged public, which is nice to hear.
Yeah, so how do you reconcile that, given the kind of the differing opinions?
I think the simplest way of looking at it is everyone was very polite to each other, which was another interesting and very welcome approach. There was very little arguing. I think we've exhausted ourselves over the last 2 years having public meetings and discussions at Planning Commission level, and I think all the heat has left the argument. What's actually happened now is that people are beginning to recognize that there are a diversity of needs and opinions, and I think what we probably need to do is be more sophisticated and specific in our analysis. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. Hopefully that's not how the finished map will appear. At first blush, it might be a fairly simple, broad-brush approach to planning, but when we go in and start to refine the maps and refine the codes, it may be different areas are treated a little bit differently with a little closer focus. Certain areas, maybe the Hoytsville area and the Woodland area would be different to the areas around Camas and Francis and around Colville and Hanover. And we probably just need to take a more detailed look at the large countywide map. It's very tricky to come up with some simple solutions. So probably just a much more detailed analysis and recognition of what those needs are.
Yeah, so do you think you need new or different zones for South Summit where they're not as popular?
I don't think necessarily they need to be new. Maybe just a more careful wording as to how and the why. Currently, we have draft zones in place. The details of those really still need to be fleshed out. Everyone is quite fascinated by the map. What they really want to do is point to a location on the map, identify their own properties, find out what zone they're in. But beyond that, there are codes associated with that. There's the written law that people need to understand and get to grips with and find out what the actual implications are going to be. Maybe there's a room for tweaking, maybe an additional zone, maybe a 10-acre as opposed to a 20-acre or a 6-acre, something in between. But I don't really think it's that going to be drastic. Going to be that drastic. It might be more to do with a simple tweaking of the use table, the methods and analyses that we use to actually approve projects might actually resolve our problems for us.
So these are all agricultural zones. I mean, and these are being proposed compared to what now? I mean, is it just all one unit per 40 acres or?
They're called agricultural zones. I think it's the AG acronym that was placed at the beginning, that was in recognition that Eastern Summit County is essentially an agricultural county. I think you've just heard that there's, the agricultural basis of the state is very important to the state. It's the same on the east side. It's recognized that agriculture is very important and protecting industry as far as that goes. To what extent you can actually legitimately call an AG1 zone, a one-acre lot, a one-acre density zone, as truly agricultural that's probably up for debate. It's a recognition that agricultural uses are protected, but there's going to be a different set of uses allowed in that zone. The AG1 is the most obvious one that people will recognize, different to what, and it essentially replaces and extends what people now know as that existing highway corridor zone. That's currently a zone that runs along many of the roads on the east side of Summit County, extends a specific distance, currently 250 feet either side of the center line of the road. That's a one unit per acre zone. That is proposed to be extended, widened, and lengthened along certain roads. The AP40 is a current zone. And within that area, we're looking towards a 6-acre zone and a 20-acre zone, and then a new 40-acre zone, to, you know, which would essentially replace that existing 40-acre AP40. Outside that, we currently have an AG100 and an AG160 zone, which would be 1 unit per 100 acre and 1 unit per 160 acre. The interesting thing about that is that state law actually allows anyone with more than 100 acres to split off a lot. So in essence, the 160-acre zone can be divided. And so we've elected right now to combine the AG100 and AG160 and then change it to a single AG80 zoning. So that would be 1 unit per 80.
So for like more dense developments like the Oakley Bench Farms, I mean, that's still in agricultural zone and they just had enough property to do that kind of density?
I'm going to say yes. You're speaking about something that exists and I'm going to assume was before my time, as I'm not fully recognizant of the name. But we are also, the other thing that is important to know, we are introducing three other zones: the rural residential zone, a residential subdivision zone, and what we're calling a recreation commercial zone. These are opportunities for rezones from the base zone. The base zone would be AG1, 6, 20, 40, 80. It would then be possible for a developer to come in, and the most obvious and dense one would be the residential subdivision, and that would be a typical subdivision that you see that could be as dense as 1 unit or 3 units per acre, 1/3 acre lots. That would come in with a full set of master planning criteria. It would come in with curb and gutter and road and sewer services to be applied to it. The other zones, we're assuming that the 1 acre lot size is associated more with a well and septic and the more dispersed rural environment and the agricultural environment. But if someone had a large enough parcel of land and the wherewithal and the means and the energy and wished to come in with a full residential subdivision, we have a rezone that they could attempt to go through that process. And what we're trying to do is make the processes as simple as possible. The analysis needs to be complex, but the processes need to be simpler, more predictable, easier for people to go through.
So you've identified these three new zones on the map. I mean, and are something like the residential subdivision, I mean, that's being proposed next to existing cities and towns, possible for annexation? Or
that would be the ideal scenario, but no, they are not identified on the map. The idea is that the map itself, as currently drawn, is a base map. That we've identified the base areas. So, for example, outside a city, you might have an AG6 or an AG20, which would be a 6-acre zoning or 20-acre zoning. The owner of a piece of land, if they were near one of the city centers and wished to annex into a city to take advantage of, say, a higher density rezoning, they could do that. Alternatively, they could approach us and look to rezone into one of the higher density rural residential or residential subdivision zones. The dilemma we have in that scenario is, to what extent would the county's zoning ordinances be competing with an existing municipality's zoning ordinances? If the municipality, for example, around Oakley, had water and sewer available, it would be in the county's interest as well as in the city's interest for anyone adjacent to that zone to be actually incorporated, annexed into the city itself and take advantage of those existing infrastructure requirements.
So that rural residential, how many units per acre is that?
The rural residential, that's a 1 unit per 1 acre. That's the same as the AG1. The difference essentially is that the use table would be adjusted. There would be certain uses not allowed. For example, we wouldn't be necessarily be allowing a mink farm or, you know, your pygmy goat breeding ground inside the rural residential zone. It would actually be a residential zone with the agriculture would be typically not allowed, although there'd be some obvious, you know, non-impact uses would be allowed.
Yeah. And why the name recreation commercial? Why not just commercial? Because, I mean, it sounds like what this allows for are ski shops and hotels as opposed to grocery stores and laundromats.
Well, the existing commercial, we do have existing commercial, light industrial, and industrial zones, you know, the typical ones that you have. We don't have as many on the east side as you do on the west side. The recreation commercial, it's something that we're sadly lacking. We have a spa process where someone, for example, I'll use Blue Sky, for example, which comes in under a spa process, and we argue about the details about how that can be zoned in a particular way and can be an allowed use in the agricultural zone. We're looking for true recreation projects. Those recreation projects could, you know, they could include something like the High Star Ranch over in Heba. There could be the Blue Sky, not Heba, over near Camas, the Blue Sky Ranch over near Wanship, and perhaps smaller opportunities, something that may involve the recreation component around Echo Lake, for example. Something that involves recreation would come in with a true master planned project, but rather than go through the SPAR project, it would be a rezone opportunity associated with a master plan and could include a variety of uses. As yet to be fleshed out in the details of the code. So people, you know, who are interested in that type of zoning may need to want to pay special attention as we work through those.
So what happens from here?
The Planning Commission are going to have another public hearing on November 19th. But on the 12th, we're actually going to have a work session with the Eastside Planning Commission. We're going to have a special meeting to run through all the comments we've heard so far. Obviously, you know, I don't know to what extent people are familiar with that. At the end of the last meeting, the Planning Commission ran through their diverse set of opinions. The Planning Commission themselves, I'm sure, have seven different opinions about what we should, how we should progress and detail the rest of it. We're going to take the public input that we heard at the last two meetings, thrash around amongst ourselves at a work session, what tweaks need to be changed, what projects need to address, what zoning changes, what language needs to be changed, tweaked or left as is, or perhaps even thrown out altogether. Then we'll go back for a public hearing on December the 19th. And the Planning Commission, I don't know to what extent what happens after that. If the Planning Commission could actually move it up to the Council, but there will be a repeat stage of everything we've just been through at the Council level, presumably in the new year.
Okay. Not before the only Eastside Council member, David Yore, is off the Council then, huh?
That's unfortunate, yes. And that is going to be an interesting dilemma, but that's politics way above my pay grade, so...
Okay.
Not going to comment on that one.
Okay, Peter, anything else you'd like to let people know?
I would say we've had a lot of public input. I'm very impressed with the way people have paid attention to it and the amount of thought that they've put into it. I hope they continue to do so. And if they have any questions, please contact this office, phone or email. We'd be happy to communicate and explain what we can and listen to your concerns.
All right. That's Summit County Planning and Zoning Administrator Peter Barnes. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
8:33 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW with a Park City Planning Commission meeting tomorrow starting at 5:30 in the studio to preview the agenda. I have planners Kirsten Whetstone, Andrea Grand, along with Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So first up, the Land Management Code amendments regarding vertical zoning storefront. A public hearing will be open, but you're continuing it till the 17th?
Yeah, that's right. Kirsten Whetstone's been handling this one for us. And basically what it is there's some regulations out there that require storefronts on Main Street elevation, so we don't get a lot of offices and we don't see real estate offices. The idea is to encourage local businesses and shops on the street, and all we're doing now is refining the final map in the area of the Town Lift Bridge.
All right. And what we decided is that that won't apply down on lower Main Street?
Past the bridge, it won't apply. So south of the bridge towards old historic Main Street, it will apply.
All right, Kirsten, also we've got a pre-master plan development review for the IHC area. And as we spoke last time, I mean, this is really to whether or not we allow more density there?
Well, and the item on Wednesday will be a discussion of part of their pre-MPD request for an amendment to their master plan at Intermountain Healthcare. And that is the question of whether to subdivide Lot 8 into two parts, one for the Peace House and then one as an open space parcel. And the density issue will be continued until December or maybe even beyond that, as we need additional discussion with property owners, the other property owners within the master plan, which is the city, and just a general discussion of the what counts as in terms of a unit equivalent, in terms of whether it's whether recreational facilities require that, fire stations. And that discussion, we have not had a lot of time to take to get into the details. So we're suggesting two requests. One is to discuss, actually it's really a ratification of their nod of approval for the subdivision split, and then a request to continue. The density issue.
So why do you even need to split Lot 8, though? I mean, if it's going to be open space in one building, what difference does it make?
I think it has to do with the way IHC would like to manage the site in terms of their ground lease for the Peace House, and that it identifies a smaller lot for the Peace House.
All right, so...
And most of the other part of the lot is wetlands anyway. You wouldn't be able to build anything on it the way it sits.
So staff recommendation is to approve that then?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Also on the agenda, we're talking about some sign code changes to increase clarity. Whose topic is this?
Apparently that one's mine. And McKenna Holly has been doing a terrific job trying to manage this thing. And she's actually been working with two legal assistants to get this done. This results from a United States Supreme Court decision to make signs more, for lack of a better phrase, content neutral. So that municipalities can regulate the size and location of signs, but some of the regulations about what actually goes on the sign we had to take out of the sign code. So it's about 30 pages of work for McKenna to try and clean this up. They've been doing a great job. She's done a terrific job in getting it organized. It's highly detailed, and unless you are a sign person, it's not really going to matter. There are some changes coming forward. With respect to the size of signs for the ski areas, because they have a number of signs out there and we're trying to regulate fairly between the two resorts inside of our city limits.
So give me an example, though, what you can now say on a sign that we couldn't before.
It's the reverse. So, for example, on political signs, sometimes we were able to regulate what was on a political sign or how big it was, and now we can't regulate that. Some of the signs, we can't necessarily talk about what is on a store sign now because we need to regulate the sign fairly between all sorts of signs. So it's basically being content neutral. You can't talk about what's on the sign. You can talk about how big it is. And it's a Supreme Court decision, came out of Gilbert, Arizona, and it's very complicated. But I think McKenna did a great job.
Sounds like you're simplifying it, though.
We are simplifying as best we can.
Okay. Let's see. And Anya, also a consideration of some land management code amendments to expand the historic sites inventory. We've talked about this before. We're finally ready to move it on to city council?
Correct. So this time, instead of just coming up with the concepts and reviewing it with the preservation board and the planning commission, we actually redlined the land management code, and we're trying to get into the more detail-orientedness of relocations, reconstructions, panelizations, and the role of the Historic Preservation Board.
Okay, so this is actually being more inclusive of what's out there.
Correct.
Adding more to the inventory.
Right, so we're actually expanding our criteria for significant. Right now, landmark are our best buildings. They're the ones that are either eligible or listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In the past, significant meant that you had your essential historical form, which we've noticed that some buildings still have a lot of historic integrity, even if they don't have that original form, and this is our way of capturing it.
All right. So is there a recommendation now that the Planning Commission move forward with this?
Yeah, so they have to make a recommendation to City Council so that we can bring City Council their comments.
All right. Any Anybody unhappy with what's being proposed?
We'll find out tomorrow.
Okay. Also, just wanted to mention that you and another planner
Hannah Turpin.
Just returned back from Washington, D.C. to do what exactly?
We were attending the National Trust Conference. The National Trust for Historic Preservation is actually the largest nationwide preservation nonprofit. And so they put on a conference every year. We learned about, you know, Main Street businesses, pretty much anything related to preservation, interpretation of historic sites, how you can use technology to not only engage the public in the interpretation of historic sites, but also for protection. We learned about Mount Vernon and how they're actually protecting open space by measuring the height of trees and making sure views aren't blocked from Washington's home. So I think we took back a lot that we'll probably be sharing with, obviously, the planning department and then our boards and commissions.
Yeah, so are we doing it right here in Parks, doing it right in Park City?
Yeah, I think we're moving in the right direction. We're really lucky in that we have a council that's very supportive of preservation and that we have a lot of tools in our preservation toolbox.
Okay, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
It's 8:40 now. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the freedom to eat what you love is the topic of tomorrow's free lunchtime learning at the PC Mark. In the studio with details, I have wellness coordinator Dondi Shira-Likes, along with this month's guest, Erin Kay. She's a health and wellness coach. Welcome.
Thank you, Leslie.
So the details, Dondi?
Okay, so I'm here to invite the community to our free lunchtime learning tomorrow from 12 to 1 at the Mark. And to introduce Erin Kay, health and wellness coach, who's going to talk to us tomorrow about our relationship with sugar.
All right, so perfect timing, Erin, now that we've finished off the leftover Halloween candy.
Right, going into the holidays.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yep. So a challenge for many of us for the next 2 months. What are you going to be talking about specifically?
I am going to be talking about the different names of sugar, you know, so that people are aware that there are different types of sugar and how to balance that intake of sugar. That's what it's all about. It's all about balance and choosing healthier alternatives.
So it's really not a good idea to eat what we love if it is full of sugar, though, right?
Of course, yes. But there's a thing I like to call 80-20. You know, 80% good, clean, healthy, real food. And, you know, 20% is life. But you can make better decisions and good decisions if you have the knowledge.
Yeah. Lots of confusion. I think this is probably one of what you were kind of referring to about added sweeteners. I mean, certainly maple syrup and honey considered natural products. But really, our bodies don't know the difference between those and just white table sugar, or does it?
You know, artificial sweeteners are a big topic right now. And I think tomorrow I really want to hit on what those are and what they do to our body and the effects on our body. Because, yes, honey and maple sugar are great alternatives. But I want the people to know, my community to know, what artificial sweeteners are really doing to our body.
Okay, that's a whole different.
That's a whole different ballgame. Yeah, that our bodies don't process those kind of artificial sweeteners. They process them differently than honey and maple sugar.
Yeah, and interesting too is that, I mean, because of the sweetness, I mean, that just automatically, even though there's no glucose or whatever in it, it kind of signals your brain that it is sweet and the body needs to start
manufacturing. I want more. It's a carb. It's energy. Mm. But then what's not used for energy is stored as fat. So I'm excited for tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to educating my community and getting out there and letting the people know what I do and how I do it.
Okay. So what do you do, I mean, as a health and wellness coach? I mean, is that your full-time?
I work for Wyndham Park City right now, but my small business on the side is health coaching clients one-on-one, and I enjoy working with them to help them learn how to better take care of themselves and boost their energy and health and calm their mind, body, and soul. It's about the whole person, not just what we put in our mouth.
Okay, good. That's happening again at the Mark tomorrow, starting at noon until 1 o'clock. People can bring their leftover Halloween candy, I suppose, and then feel guilty about
it. Yes, so hopefully we'll see everyone tomorrow at noon at the Mark.
Yes.
And thank you very much.
Okay, Dondi and Erin.
Thank you so much.
Well, a second Bonanza Park and Lower Park Avenue Alternatives Prioritization Workshop will be held tonight, 6 to 8 p.m., at the Park City Marriott. In the studio with me, I have Phyllis Robinson and Alfred Knotts. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the second meeting to do what? Just get more public input?
So
this is really two meetings in one. So we'll be talking tonight about the Lower Park Avenue area. This is the final of our workshops before we go to council for some direction on how council wishes staff to move forward. And what we're looking at for Lower Park Ave is what we have, you know, city-owned properties at Miners Hospital, where the fire station currently sits, the land behind it, the parking lot at the library, and Mulwinnie. So we're looking to say where is the best location to provide community space, flex space that could include senior programming, may include, you know, youth programming. We've had some requests to really look carefully at childcare. So looking at PC Tots and other childcare options in town, as well as other community amenities. And one thing that's bubbled up over the years is a community kitchen. We've had, you know, people asking about some additional outdoor space, play space, plaza space. So what we're asking first and foremost, and following up on our last council meeting, is where does that community space want to be? Where is the best, where does it make the most sense for that type of building structure to be? And in order to move forward then with looking at other uses. So that's what we're looking for tonight. We did some prioritization last week with the community, big maps, sticky dots, pros, cons. And so we'll be doing that as half of the workshop tonight. And then we switch to Alfred.
To talk about transportation?
Correct. And just looking at the project area of Bonanza Park, our study also does include Lower Park Avenue. So we want to show that correlation to the community. The uses that Phyllis just spoke about with the potential for senior center services, childcare, obviously all of that needs to be served by transportation. And what is that? So we're also looking at the potential for areas within Bonanza Park to be a park and ride locations. It is the confluence of our two state highway systems, 224, 248. So it provides a lot of opportunity in that area, and we're really trying to just flush out what those alternatives are. We're actually in a different phase of the project than Phyllis is. She's looking to kind of get some final recommendations. We're looking to really get our initial recommendations and what the scope of our project is.
Yeah, do we have anything that's being proposed?
There is. There's approximately 21 alternatives that we listed or showed last week. They range from bus rapid transit locations, walkability, connections to bike and ped facilities, just overall parking, park and ride, and then also there's the potential for some aerial connections too. And I know that was identified and talked about in the newspaper just the other day. A lot of that has come out historically from our previous planning studies through our transportation and traffic master plan. Does identify potential aerial connections in these locations and to these origins and destinations, and then also the potential to have just overall intersection improvements. 224 has been studied at Kearns for a potential roundabout. So we're really looking forward to come out with concrete recommendations and alternatives to move forward into future project development. And that's really preliminary engineering and making sure that we can get these projects on the ground.
Yeah, and when I think about, you know, park and ride or aerial connections, I mean, that just brings more cars to that area. I mean, at this point, I mean, we've got a Bonanza Road, two-lane road. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would we want to add even more traffic to that?
Well, we're looking at kind of strategic locations. We're not looking for a massive kind of incubator for automobiles, really. We're looking for some minor, smaller intercept lots, potentially with affordable housing locations within Bonanza Park and how those land uses work together. There's already going to be some automobile traffic, but just trying to keep it out of the congested areas. Really also looking at where those BRT lines do come in for the remote parking. Remote parking is one of our major strategies, looking out at Kimball and then looking out at Quinn's and then being able to bus rapid transit into there, and that would potentially be where that seamless location is to connect into an aerial location.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, as someone who has to kind of suffer through it, that making that left-hand turn onto Bonanza from Prospector, you know, lunchtime or, you know, just after 5 o'clock, I mean, it already feels like that intersection is failing. Are there any ideas for how we manage that?
Yes, and maybe you should be a transportation engineer because it is failing, actually. So we are looking at that. And the other intersection that fails, too, is Bonanza at 248. They're also a monitor, that right-hand turning movement. So we're looking at all of these larger improvements, but also some near-term fixes, such as potential roundabouts at those two locations. So that is an option also. So that's really what we're trying to flesh out and then be able to prioritize our fiscal resources over the next 3 to 5 years when we do our capital programming. So, and then also we have to deal with UDOT and make sure that we can get on their list of needs and wants also. So that's kind of our job, to move these things forward and making sure that we're queued up to deliver these projects.
All right. So what people see then at tonight's meeting?
They'll see we actually had the 21 alternatives last time. We've actually added a few of those based on the public comment we got. So they'll see schematics and just concept drawings. We really haven't done any quantitative analysis on these alternatives. Doing transportation modeling and other technical analysis is very expensive. So we really want to weed down what these alternatives are. Obviously, don't want to evaluate 37 on a technical basis. We want to go ahead and flush out kind of qualitatively what the community sees as being valid or feasible or even politically feasible, and then be able to weed those down to a more manageable set of alternatives, which we'll bring back to the community later on in the winter.
All right. So in terms of the gondola connection there from perhaps the Bonanza Park area, this would go to the resort. So is it a resort plan or is it something the city's proposing?
It would be a potential for a public-private partnership. I mean, the resort is our is a destination. It's a traffic generator just like any other business would be or any other type of shopping center or mall. This is just kind of in our resort community. This is actually what our destination is. So how we spend public dollars, that's not yet to be determined, and whether we even do it to that extent. So some of the other alternatives that were brought up was also bringing potentially an aerial connection into Old Town if there's going to be one up to that area too. So that would be the concept of that being a a major node there, potentially at Olympic Plaza and or Bonanza Park also, because that's really where our BRT systems, what we're proposing or analyzing, are going to come into.
All right. So if anyone has any good ideas, tonight's the night to show up and let you know about them, huh?
Please. And I think we might have to keep scheduling these because every time we do it, it snows. So.
I know. last Wednesday, we had the great early snowfall.
Correct.
So.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope. Just 6 to 8 this evening. Looking forward to it. Little food little food beforehand. So we'll get started promptly at 6:10.
Okay. Alfred and Phyllis, thanks for coming
thanks.
In.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, as part of the 10th Annual Filmmakers Showcase, the Park City Film Series will be showing the award-winning documentary Peace Officers, a standalone film, on Sunday evening. Joining me now on the phone, I have the film's directors Scott Christofferson and Brad Barber. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, I've got to try and figure out who's here. So let me know who's talking. I mean, just to start and tell us a little bit about the story of Peace Officer.
Yeah, Brad, go ahead. This is Brad.
Okay, thanks, Brad.
Sure, yeah. Peace Officer is a documentary about the militarization of police. We follow a man named Dub Lawrence, who actually used to be a sheriff here in Utah in Davis County. He started the first SWAT team back in the 70s, and that same SWAT team a few years ago actually killed his son-in-law in a controversial standoff. So Dub has now become kind of obsessed with uncovering the truth about what happened, and he kind of reaches out to a lot of other people that have been on the receiving end of SWAT raids and other kind of new militaristic uses of police force.
So the first SWAT team in the country, really, here in Utah?
Oh, no, sorry, in Utah, the first SWAT team in
okay.
Utah.
Oh, okay, okay. I was going to say. And what was the need for such a thing back in the 70s? I mean, Utah at that point still pretty provincial.
Well, he at the time had seen the Ted Bundy case develop. He kind of helped break the Ted Bundy case and felt like there was a need that was going to be spreading around the country. It was pretty soon after the Los Angeles Police Department had established the first SWAT team in the country after the Watts riots, and he says that he felt like it was just the right thing to do to be prepared for those kinds of actions just in case. But he also says, you know, he couldn't have foreseen how the use of the SWAT team would change over the years and be used so much more often now for much, you know, lower level offenses and more nonviolent offenses.
Yeah. So, Scott, how did you even come across the story? Did you know this Dub?
I actually knew Dub's son, and I was playing a softball game. I happened to be in Utah at the time in the summer of 2012, and Dub kind of approached me at the end of the game and said, "Hey, I want you to teach me how to edit." And then he took me back to his septic tank business warehouse and showed me this two-hour-long video analysis of his son-in-law's shooting death. And I was really taken aback with Dub's obsession. And then after that, Brad and I started chatting. We were working on another film of Brad's, and you know, we ended up driving from Utah to Oregon on working on a film and ended up talking about Dub the whole way and decided that we were going to begin shooting the film. We weren't sure if it was going to be a short or a feature, and it just kind of grew from Dub's kind of obsessive work in this arena.
Yeah, it's the irony there is amazing. I mean, without giving too much away, you want people to come see it, but I mean, how does he reconcile that with himself? I mean, kind of the precursor to his son-in-law's death, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of an interesting story and ironic twist, certainly. I think Dub, sees how the SWAT team has changed over the years. And, you know, I think when Dub started the SWAT team, he saw it as a way to diffuse violence and resolve violent situations nonviolently, hopefully. And I think he's seen it kind of gravitate towards more of the use of force and also using kind of SWAT tactics as an investigative tool. And so I think Dub feels like it's gone in the wrong direction.
Hmm. So given the increasing national conversation about police brutality and how militarized it's become, I mean, what does peace officer show?
Brad,
this is Brad. The film, it does serve as a bit of a microcosm for things that are happening not just in Utah but around the country. Because when Scott and I first started filming, we had been hearing about different cases like this in the news. We knew that the West Valley police were under investigation by the FBI for something similar, and it seemed odd to us that that was happening in a place like Utah. As you say earlier, it didn't really seem like the type of place that would need that many SWAT raids or kind of this type of force being used so often. And we started wondering, if it's happening this much in Utah, maybe it's happening all over the place, not just in big urban areas like we tend to think of it. And, as the news for the last few months, I think, has increasingly shown, that's exactly what's happening. So it's a local story, but it's definitely a national issue.
So what's the reaction been from law enforcement? Or have you heard?
Yeah, I think different law enforcement, I think nationally, as we've toured, we've gone to all over the U.S., places all over the U.S., as well as internationally in Australia and New Zealand. I think police have been really responsive. They've supported the film. They've felt like, yeah, there does need to be some reform. I think some of the police officers here in Utah, understandably so, were frustrated with their own cases being critiqued and analyzed, and that's certainly understandable. But I think we tried really hard to give police a voice. And, I come from a family of law enforcement. My grandfather was in the FBI for 25 years, so it was really important to us to put the audience in the shoes of police to understand what they go through. I think for us, we realize it's more of a systemic issue, where really the police and the receivers of SWAT raids both are victims. They're victims of this kind of being put in these crazy situations when they really don't need to be.
Well, congratulations. Your film won both the Grand Jury and Audience Award prizes at South by Southwest last spring. Again, it's going to be screened in its entirety Sunday evening, 6 o'clock. Admission is free. It's the final film for the 10th Annual Filmmakers Showcase. And you're going to be in town. My understanding is that Virginia Pierce with the Utah Film Commission will be moderating a Q&A with both of you, as well as Dub Lawrence, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the plan. Virginia's, she's awesome. She's a good friend of mine, so I'm excited to have her there, too.
Okay. Well, appreciate your time this morning, Scott and Brad. Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.